The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled Media Mavericks. In this column, Essence Ventures CEO and President Caroline Wanga explores Black women as chief executive officers of home, culture, and community, and focuses on helping every Black woman recognize the chief that already exists within her by introducing the ones who live among us. Rashida Jones is a trailblazing media executive and currently serves as the president of MSNBC, a role she assumed in February 2021. She's the first Black woman to lead a major cable news network, a significant milestone in the industry. With a background in journalism and a keen eye for innovative content, Jones has been instrumental in shaping the network's programming and editorial direction. Under her leadership, MSNBC has continued to thrive, balancing hard-hitting news coverage with insightful political analysis. Caroline said, "How do you navigate the conflict between following your intuition and adhering to societal or corporate pressures, especially when yours is a genuine story of success that includes failure?" Jones responded, "I think if anything, those moments where I was too afraid to take the leap, but I knew I should have, are probably the bigger lessons. I think much less that way now, but it's one of the things that I see most often with peers and mentees. Like, I knew I could have gone for that, but I didn't get the validation from other people, so I didn't. Or I could have spoken up. I could have taken on that challenge. I could have gone for that job, especially in the case where you see the results and feel like I knew that was the thing to do." Caroline responded, "When you see something affirmed," Jones said, "don't wait for that. I think not being afraid to fail is liberating. I think sometimes failure is liberating. I can think of moments when I could have not made this call, and I made that call, and I learned so much from it, and I owned it, and I was able to grow from it." Caroline said, "I love that. So you go to a different type of newsroom. What are your aspirations now?" Jones said, "So I am running the newsroom in South Carolina. I think I am going to be there maybe 5+ years, and then I'll move to a bigger city like Charlotte or something like that. I am 2 years in and NBC comes calling. I was part of the NBC family because I worked for an affiliate, and my mentor at the time, my boss, Yvette Milley, called me up and said, 'You know, we want to talk to you about being a showrunner for one of our cable showrooms.' I remember saying, 'This will be a fun day and a half in New York. Like, obviously, there's no way I'm moving to New York. I have small kids. You know, it was the three of us at the time. There's no way I am moving to New York.' So I come up here, I go through the process, and when I walked out the door, I said, 'We are going to become New Yorkers. This is happening.'" Caroline responded, "At what point in your story does being a black woman impact things one way or another? Rashida responded, I think it's always there. It's always impacts things. There was a point years ago, and I think some of it is the culture of this company, where the expectations is for you to walk in the room being yourself. The expectation is that you bring something different and unique to the table. You know, this is a company where most of my peers are women. Many of my peers are people of color. And it's something that is celebrated here. And as a leader, and as I continue to move up the ranks, it's become more of a priority for me. You know, I might be the person in the meeting who drops a Jay-Z lyric, but I'm not hiding my interest. I might pop up in the meeting with braids. I might wear a Hampton t-shirt. I purposefully celebrate those parts of my personality and my life because I want to make sure all of the people around me and the people who work with me and for me are comfortable being themselves. And so I think I am unapologetically a black woman. I consider it a superpower. My unique perspective that I bring to the table is not only important, but it's expected. How dare I sit around a decision-making table and not bring my life experience into the conversation? Because part of my value is having a different life experience. Caroline responded, can you tell me about the day Rashida becomes president of MSNBC? Jones responded, wow. So it was one of those things that I won't ever forget. I remember my boss setting up a phone meeting with me because I was taking some time off. And at the last minute, it turned from a phone call to a video meeting. I was about to get on the road to drive to my parents' house. Caroline said, you had no idea what this call was going to be about? Jones said, I did not know. And I had on my glasses and hair up in a bun. And I remember I had on like this funky tie-dyed sweatshirt. I had no other clothes with me. And I was like, all right, I have 15 minutes until this meeting. That's where I started. But like 5 minutes out, I said, let me at least take the bun down and take my glasses off. And there's no makeup happening. And tie-dye it is. I am literally telling the kids I need 10 minutes for a quick call. And then we are going to get on the road. And so I have a conversation with my boss, and it is a very serious conversation. This is a moment, and we are talking about things. And then I remember closing my laptop, and my daughter is sitting at the dining room table beside me. I just put my head down on the table because the weight of the moment is hitting me. I just want it. It was almost like I wanted to capture that moment in real time. But again, I was heading to my parents' house. So I just texted my siblings. They both live in the area. And it said, everybody meet over mom and dad's at 5:30. I want to share some news with you guys. I was able to tell everyone in person, which didn't often happen because, you know, I live far away from everybody. But I was able to share the moment in person with everyone, which was really special. And then the day that it was shared publicly, I remember so clearly the 10 minutes before the news came out. I remember just sitting there in silence and thinking, this is the beginning of a big milestone for all of us. Caroline said, yeah, because, you know, we claim it for all of us in our community. Rashida said, I think that is part of the mission. That's part of why I know it is important for me to continue to pour everything into their role, because I'm doing something not only that hasn't been done before, but that also means so much to so many people. Caroline asks the next question. There are people right now who are inspired by your story and looking to find the chief within themselves for these millions of Black women. What would you give them as guidance for finding the chief within themselves, regardless of what level they are at, or regardless of the industry? Jones responded, I think one of the keys is to give yourself grace. It's not going to be perfect every time. It's not going to be what you expected every time, but you have to give yourself the space and grace to make mistakes, to pivot, to learn. I think a lot of times we are so hard on ourselves, harder than the world could ever be, because we have such high expectations for ourselves. So I think that's number one. And then number two is going for it. Go for something a little bit bigger. I remember when I was in college, I applied for an internship at the NBA because I thought there was no way I was going to get it. You know, I am this little student in Hampton, and I remember getting the letter because, again, this is before everything was digital. So I get a letter in the mail and it said that I was accepted. And I thought it was fake. I thought it was fake because how did I get this? Why did they pick me? And I saw it and really didn't process it. And then I got a phone call and I was like, what? This is for real? Like, this is what I applied for, but I didn't expect to get it. Find the chief in you and expect the success. Expect the goal. Expect the big win. Caroline said, expect the goal. Expect the big win. Where do you go from here, Madam Intuition? I mean, you are the president of MSNBC. I am not trying to say anything about she ain't going nowhere, MSNBC laughs, but what is your next milestone? Jones responds, I have a lot of work to do here. I want to continue to grow the brand. I've got such an incredible team. I want to continue to be able to tell stories on every single platform. So I have a lot of work to do here. The next article is titled, The Soundtrack of Our Lives. As we approach Essence Festival's 30th anniversary, we reflect on the music that gave the beloved celebration its heartbeat. The 4th of July weekend in New Orleans holds a special significance, not just for locals, but for music enthusiasts and aficionados of Black culture worldwide. It's a time when the Big Easy becomes a nexus of Blackness. The city is buzzing with fans, socialites, celebrities, and artists who have journeyed to the birthplace of jazz for one season and reason to reveal in the Essence Festival of Culture, hosted within the symbolic embrace of the Deep South, the Essence Festival takes on a character all its own. Having found its natural home in New Orleans, a hotbed of Black music and heritage, more than just a backdrop for the festivities, the city becomes an indispensable element that defines the festival itself. It's a true sanctuary for Black music. While the pages of the magazine serve as a platform to amplify Black women's voices. Essence Fest went a step further, carving out a space for the expression of Black artistry. It was a brilliant move, in part because it addressed a void. America's overt racism made celebrating Black music on such a broad scale nearly impossible. In the 1980s, for example, MTV faced backlash for its neglect of Black artists, including its refusal to air Rick James's Super Freak. Before Michael Jackson's Billie Jean video, Black artists rarely appeared on MTV. Jackson's immense popularity and the pressure from CBS eventually led MTV to air Billie Jean in 1983, which helped break the color barrier on the network. In a landscape where Black music and culture were often overlooked by mainstream media and music festivals, Essence Fest was unwavering in the focus on uplifting Black people. By the mid-1990s, Essence co-founder Ed Lewis was galvanized by the magazine's success, which birthed a vision that transcended the pages of the publication. The festival began as an extension of the magazine to commemorate its 25th anniversary in 1995. It has since evolved into a global phenomenon. Lewis and his team spared no expense back then, landing the magazine's quarter century of existence with a celebration that surpassed all expectations. I wanted to do something a little bit different. Instead of just having the big party here in New York and thanking everyone, Lewis explained, reflecting on the genesis of the festival in the Own Time of Essence documentary, which traces the history of the brand. The jazz promoter George Wynn said to me, "Ed, have you ever thought about doing a music festival in New Orleans over the 4th of July weekend at the Superdome? No one comes to New Orleans over the 4th of July weekend unless there's a real reason." And I said, "Oh my God, he may be onto something." That conversation planted the seeds of cultural movements. It gave rise to the annual Essence Music Festival, which blossomed into a worldwide celebration of Black culture. When it comes to programming, as each day's lively atmosphere shifts into night, musical performances take center stage, where the sound isn't just heard, but deeply felt. The thoughtfully curated lineups span a wide spectrum of genres, speaking to the notion that all music inherently embodies elements of Black culture and making the festival a platform for the diversity of Black musical expression. I think we have always tried to find ways to incorporate the different genres of music that were birthed out of New Orleans, explains Hakeem Holmes, vice president of what is now called the Essence Festival of Culture. A NOLA native, Holmes joined the festival team as an intern in 2013 and has witnessed the growth and evolution of the event. "So there's jazz. We leaned a lot into gospel, and then in terms of Mardi Gras, Indian music, bounce music, these are genres that don't have as much visibility or weren't given stadium opportunities. I think that too is essential to the experience of the Essence Festival." In 1995, the festival's inaugural year, the landscape of music was changing right before our eyes, with a wealth of Black acts in the pipeline. Pop darlings Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, and Tina Turner had all released projects within the decade, while the younger generation, which included Brandy, Monica, and Usher, was just entering the scene. The festival's first lineup was indicative of the time, with a billing that included artists like Patti LaBelle, Aaliyah, and Trim Brass Band, and the Ohio Players, to name a few. These stars set a precedent for the caliber of talent that would come to define the yearly festival. James Diamond Williams, the drummer of the funk ensemble Ohio Players, highlighted how the festival showcased the diverse range of Black music and its widespread appeal across the country. In 1988 or 89, we had released a new album on Track Records, Williams says. So at Essence Festival in 1995, this band brought funk. We were forefathers of that institution, of that musical talent, and we are quite proud of that. We wrote two platinum albums in 1 year, a feat that I think has yet to be achieved since then. Meanwhile, in 1994, Miss Patti had released Gems, adding another smash hit to her discography. Her song, Right Kind of Lover, peaked at number 8 on the Billboard Hot R&B / Hip Hop Songs chart and spent 25 weeks there, a precursor of what was to come at the first festival. Likewise, Aaliyah, who made waves in her 1994 debut album, Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, took a bow on the festival main stage, captivating the audience with hits like Back and Forth, which reached number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 on July 2nd, 1994, precisely 1 year to the day before the festival performance. The festival had its finger on the pulse of the culture, and it showed in the years that followed. In 1997, one of the featured acts was Kirk Franklin, who at the time was flipping traditional gospel music on his head with his secular revolutionary sound on God's Property from Kirk Franklin's New Nation. Franklin's groundbreaking tracks like Stomp set the stage on fire with their infectious beats, and that helped to propel his message to a larger audience. This was particularly important at a time when the gospel community was wary of his unorthodox style. That was a God's Property performance, says Franklin, of his first appearance at the festival. We were all nervous because it's gospel music on the main stage, and that was very different. On the music festival circuit, no matter how big artists became, there was a common destination, Essence Fest. It served as an obligatory venue for Black stars to perform. Whether you are performing or somebody else is performing, it meant something just to be in the room, to be able to watch people, especially entertainers, that look like you and that always came with their A game, Franklin explains. That's what Essence was. That was the standard. Even though it was an unspoken standard, you always knew you had to come with your A game because of the environment and the ecosystem that you were walking into when it comes to talent. Nobody was coming in off the cuff or just comfortable. Everybody had an agenda to present their best because that's what Essence had become known for when it came to Black presentation. Williams shares a similar sentiment. Performing meant that we were playing among the best, and it was a weekend that everybody wanted to go to. Eagle was hall to hall, wall to wall. Essence Festival was the place to be. The city was there, and you just wanted to be there. The new millennium saw a variety of up-and-comers added to the fold. There was a young Destiny's Child performing in 2001. Fresh off the release of Survivor, R&B duo Kenny Lattimore and Shantae Moore performed hits from their duet album, Things That Lovers Do, in 2004. And in 2008, Jill Scott, who had already released her trio of critically acclaimed albums, Who Is Jill Scott, Beautifully Human, and The Real Thing, hit the stage. Scott was a welcome addition to the bubbling neo-soul movement led by artists D'Angelo and Erykah Badu, both of whom graced the festival stage multiple times. The venue was the antithesis of the opulence of hip-hop's shiny suit era of the early 2000s, embodying a more eclectic and soulful aesthetic. We are standing 10 toes down that we as a culture and as a people are not a monolith, says Holmes. There is something for everyone. All of those things are coming to life to invite everybody and allow everyone to see themselves as a part of it. While the main stage acts have been known to put on a show, the other venues and the super lounges turned the spotlight on artists you may not have known before. We are creating an opportunity for people to come in and be on the big stage or in the super lounges, Holmes continues. These spaces were where we got more acquainted with alternative rap groups like De La Soul, rising R&B stars Melanie, Fiona, and Miguel, and iconic collectives like Soul Rebels, Brass Band, and George Clinton and Parliament. In the mid-2000s, a rising titan of rap emerged in the form of Kanye West. By 2005, he was coasting on the success of his debut album, The College Dropout, propelled by his hit Jesus Walks. That performance was pretty incredible when I did see it live, recalls Gina Charbonnet, the principal owner of the events company Get Char Inc. and executive producer for the festival. I think we can say that he's a prolific writer, and he might have been one of the first hip-hop artists Essence had on stage. West performed in the Essence Arena in 2005, a month before Hurricane Katrina ravaged New Orleans. He returned to perform in 2008 following his famous political outcry on national television in the aftermath of the tragic natural disaster, when he stated, "George Bush doesn't care about black people." Even during the turmoil that Katrina left in its wake, the festival pressed on. The event was temporarily moved to Houston in 2006. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.